The Deity of Jesus, the third talk in a series entitled Biblical Philosophy, the Message and Worldview of the Bible, was presented by Jack Crabtree on October 30, 2011 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2011. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
A couple of people during the week raised the question of the deity of Jesus, and I want to comment on that a little bit. As I said last week, even though I think the doctrine of the Trinity, as it is described in the creeds, although that is not a biblical idea, I distance myself from those people who reject the Trinity but also reject the deity of Jesus. And I argue that's not what I'm doing. That's not what I'm saying. I think in a very real sense, the Bible teaches that Jesus is God. But I wasn't specific last week about in what sense does the Bible teach that Jesus is God, and I want to talk about that a little bit to start off with. Ontologically speaking, and if you understand what I mean by that, ontology is of or pertaining to being, the nature of what is, the nature of what is real, the nature of the substance of a thing. From the standpoint of who God is in this creation in which we live and in which we inhabit, Jesus was made of exactly the same stuff that we are. Nothing more, nothing less than a human. So Jesus was just a plain old ordinary human being from the standpoint of his ontology, his being, his reality, his existence. Now, I think what happens in part of it is just kind of folk Christianity. Part of it is actually the considered theological position of the many centuries of Orthodox Christianity in all of its forms. But the Christian position is that Jesus is a human being, but if you were to be able to get into the nooks and crannies and the cracks between his humanity, his human elements within him, there's God stuff there. And I remember growing up, what I was told in Sunday school is that Jesus was God in every bit the same sense as the transcendent creator of all reality was God. So that technically, strictly speaking, he was omnipotent, omnipresent. What are all the other omnas that he was? But all the omnas, he was omni-everything. That Jesus was all those things, it's just that he voluntarily didn't express them, right? So he was omniscient, but he, if you will, chose to not use, I think is the language we would use, he didn't use his omniscience. So he was ignorant of things that he wouldn't have had to have been ignorant of, because being God, he knew everything. God was capable of Jesus was capable of everything that God was capable of if he used his omnipotence, but he didn't choose to use his omnipotence. So his power was limited and so on. I think that's a more typical Christian perspective. And what I'm arguing is the reason Jesus didn't know stuff is because he didn't know stuff. The reason Jesus couldn't do stuff is because he couldn't do stuff. Not because he was voluntarily not using his divinity, but it's because he was a human being with all the finiteness and limitations that implies on a human being. So when Jesus says, no one knows the time when the Son is going to return, not even the Son of Man, he means it. He doesn't mean, well, actually I know, but I'm going to pretend like I don't. He didn't actually know. Because as a human being, he hadn't been able to sort out the pieces of the prophetic picture and know enough of history to be able to know with any kind of with any definiteness. So, if he's just a human being, then why would we call him God? What's going on there? What's divine about God if he's just a human being? I like the way John puts it in the first chapter of John, and I think I've mentioned this before. John says, no one has beheld God at any time, but the Monogene Son, he has translated him. You could translate it, translate it. You could translate it, translate. He has translated him. He has interpreted him. That I think the right way to think about Jesus is that he's the translation of the one and only transcendent creator of all reality who exists beyond creation, outside of creation. That being who is the creator translated himself into a language that we can understand. He made himself a human being. And by making himself a human being, he put himself in the medium that is directly and immediately accessible to us. I mean, one of the most significant implications of that is that when you look at reality, the history, you've got little tiny insignificant little sparrows who God takes care of and feeds and keeps warm so they can live. And then he sends a tsunami that wipes out tens of thousands of people within a short period of time. So is this God good or is this God evil? If you just simply look at the way God runs his universe, there's some ambiguity to that, or at least a vagueness that makes it difficult to say. Now, ultimately, I would argue that from creation, we would ultimately know that God is good and not evil. But leaving that aside, however much we might be able to come to that conclusion, it's not a slam dunk. You don't necessarily come to that conclusion easily, because as he says in Isaiah, I am God, I create light and I create darkness. I create good and I create evil. That God is doing it all. So if he's doing it all, how are we to understand what kind of being Yahweh is? Well, against that vagueness, God has taken who he is as a person, the very person that he, the creator, is, and he has translated him into a different form, the form of a human being. And by translating himself into the form of a human being, we now have him visible to us, apparent to us, evident to us, in a medium that we get, in a medium that we understand. I know when a human being is good and when a human being is evil. At least in principle, I have the ability to judge the goodness of a human being versus the evil of a human being. So the goodness of Jesus that is evident to us, should be evident to us, is a window into the goodness of the Creator God. Why? Because Jesus is him. He's God in all of his distance and vagueness, translated into an immediately accessible form to us. So he's the translation of the very particular individual that Yahweh, God, the transcendent author of all reality, is. Let me give you some analogies. If I were to break out in song, and I won't, but if I were to break out in song, you might look in your hymnal and look at this page, this white page of paper with stained ink on it, and say, this is the song he's singing. Okay, notice the significance of what you're saying. This is the song he's singing. How can a piece of white paper stained with ink be the same as vibrating air molecules vibrating the eardrum, translated into electrical impulses across nerves, firing synapses in the brain, and then doing whatever it does from there? How on earth are those the same thing? Notice that ontologically, in terms of the stuff that makes up the song versus the stuff that makes up the musical score, there's nothing alike about them, nothing the same about them at all. And yet, there's something that transcends the medium that they come in that is the same between them, such that we don't think we're being silly when we say, this is the same song that I have turned my hymnal to. The problem is, I think, in Christian orthodoxy, the problem is we are hopelessly materialistic. And we think the only way Jesus can be God is if he has the matter of God, the substance of God, the stuff of God. If he's not materially God in some sense, then how can he be God? We have to stop being materialists and like the example of the song and the score, there's no matter that is the same between the song I'm singing and this musical score that you're looking at. The stuff is not the same, the matter is not the same, but there's some conceptual thing that is the same between the song and the score. It's only a mental thing, but mental things are real. In fact, mental things are often more real than material things, matter. So what's the same between God and Jesus? Not their stuff. Jesus has human stuff. God has transcendent stuff, if he has stuff at all. I don't think he has stuff at all, but if you want to give him stuff, he's got transcendent stuff. Jesus and God don't share transcendent stuff, but they share something very, very particular. The idea of the person and character and being of who God is has been mapped onto and imprinted onto this human being, Jesus. So that Jesus just is that transcendent being. If I took a few objects and put them on the podium here and shined a bright light here up onto the wall, I could go to a shadow and say, this is this object. I have a toaster here. This is the toaster. This is the blender. This is the coffee maker. Well, if you wanted to get nitpicky, nah, that's not the blender. That's just a shadow. Yes, ontologically, in terms of its stuff, in terms of its being, in terms of the kind of thing it is, it's just a shadow. But this particular shadow is a shadow that is caused by and derived from, what did I say, the blender? The blender and not the toaster and not the coffee maker. This, that shadow, shares the identity of this particular object, even though it's its shadow rather than it itself. Well, notice the language Paul uses in Colossians. Who is Jesus? He's the image of the invisible God. If you cast a bright enough light on the invisible God, you cast the shadow of Jesus. Jesus is his shadow in that sense, his image. Or, another way, if I'm writing a novel and for some reason I decide I want to actually have a presence in the novel, I want me to be in the novel, how am I going to do that? You know, take a shrinking pill and get small enough to get down into the pages of the book or the paper that I'm writing on? No, of course not. Even if I could get small enough, that wouldn't make me in the book. It would make me in the paper. But I still wouldn't be in the reality of the novel, in the storyline of the novel. The only way I can be a part of the story in the novel is for me to manifest myself in the story. And if I actually want to be a being who has a permanent presence in the story, I have to create a character that is me. Now, notice, and in a way, this is the best analogy of all, because notice that if I create a character that is me, that character, in a sense, has a dual identity. It has the identity of the character that is the character in the novel, a history within the novel, a plot line within the novel, an identity that's defined by the script of the novel, on the one hand, as well as having my identity. Because I've taken this character that has an identity of his own, and I've said, but this person with his human identity of his own is me, and I'm mapping my identity onto him. And therefore, he is, for all intents and purposes, me within the story. That, I think, is who Jesus is. God, the author of all reality, creating this drama, creating this story, decided to come down and have a permanent presence within the very story that he's creating. And how did he finally do that? He created a human being just like you and me, with a history of his own. He has a mother. He had a hometown. He had a childhood. I mean, he has a whole history that is his as Jesus of Nazareth. But Jesus of Nazareth is not merely Jesus of Nazareth. He's the character that God created to be himself within the story. And so when all is said and done, Thomas doesn't hesitate, recognizing the significance of the resurrection. He doesn't hesitate to say, "My Lord and my God." This man is God. But not because he's made of God stuff. He's made of human stuff and only human stuff from beginning to end, I think. Okay, let me pause for any of your questions or comments.
With that said, what about the virgin birth? And would that not, I mean, why would that even be in Scripture if he was just a man?
Okay, great question. Yeah. I think the virgin birth plays the same role as the chorus of angels singing whatever it is they sing at his birth that the shepherds heard. It's an incredibly important miracle that signals the uniqueness of this child. Note something is very striking, Richard. Notice that no apostles ever even mentioned the virgin birth. If we didn't have the account in Matthew, brief account in Matthew, and a little bit more extended account in Luke, telling us that she was a virgin, we wouldn't know that. The apostles don't ever derive any theology from the virgin birth. I dare you to find it in the Scripture, where they say, because he was born of a virgin, he's God, or because he was born of a virgin, whatever else that you might derive from it. They just don't go there. I think the only reason we know of the virgin birth, really, is because of Mary. Mary is the only person who knew, who could be confident that she was a virgin. And, I mean, everyone else was inclined to say, yeah, right. Yeah, she was a virgin, right? But she knew. She knew exactly what had transpired. She shouldn't ought to be pregnant, and she was pregnant. And so it had incredible significance for her. Remember how Luke puts it? That in connection with the other miracles that happened surrounding her birth, it says, and she treasured all these things in her heart. That Mary was gathering the evidence on what a momentous event this was, that she got pregnant without conceiving of a man, and then gave birth to this child with all the prophecies that surrounded that, with all the miracles that surrounded that, with all the care of God that surrounded that. She treasured all those things in her heart. And I think as Jesus was growing up, Mary undoubtedly told him the stories of who he was based on what the angels had said and the wise men had said and the prophets had said and right on down the line. So Jesus very early on has imparted to him from Mary an understanding of who he is. He's the promised Son of God. And he spent his whole childhood and early adulthood then figuring out what that means. What does it mean that I'm the Son of God? So remember at his bar mitzvah at 12 years old in Jerusalem, he's pumping the rabbis for information. And they're amazed at how intelligent his questions are, how informed his questions are. Why? He's undoubtedly been studying the prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and so on, trying to figure out, who am I? I'm the Son of God, but what does that mean? And he probably came across prophecies that he didn't understand. So he's going to these rabbis, can you help me understand this? Do you know what's going on here? What is this all about? So, I don't think the virgin birth, I think the virgin birth was truly a virgin birth, not a human God union. I mean, that's the way we've been inclined to read it traditionally, is that God supplied his DNA somehow, whatever that is, to the human DNA of Mary in order to make a hybrid, so that Jesus is not really a human, he's a hybrid. I think that's false. That's not the significance of the virgin birth. He didn't have deity contributed to him by God. It was truly a virgin birth. It doesn't happen in the animal kingdom, I mean in among human beings, but in the animal kingdom there is a phenomenon called parthenogenesis, where a female can simply fertilize her own egg with the DNA from another egg. And it happens occasionally. I'm inclined to think that's what happened. God just used the DNA from two eggs and produced an offspring.
See, I might be jumping the gun a little in creeds, but in the Nicene Creed, didn't they specifically put a line in about Jesus, the only begotten Son, made of one essence with the Father, by whom all things were made?
Right.
So, and that was specifically, I think, to address the Arian heresy.
Right. That's right. And I'm taking issue with that. I think they got that wrong, is what I'm suggesting.
Okay, that's why I was wondering.
Part of the problem is Jerome, when he translated the Bible into Latin, he took the word monogenes and he translated it only begotten, or the Latin form of that, of only begotten. Virtually all New Testament scholars today recognize that he made a mistake there. And some have suggested that he deliberately and intentionally mistranslated it because he was in the middle of some theological disputes and he needed the ammunition. Now, I don't know.
Instead of only begotten, what should it have been translated?
Just unique.
Unique.
One of a kind. Jesus is the unique Son, the one of a kind Son. And I think what John means by that is, we've had lots of sons of God down through the history of Israel. David was the son of God. Solomon was the son of God. Rehoboam was the son of God, right on down. Every Davidic king who sat on the throne in Israel was the son of God, bore that title. But there was one coming who was unique among the sons of God, because those sons of God, as it turns out, were little more than placeholders, people who bore were recipients of the promises of the covenant and placeholders for a promise that had never been realized. But when Jesus came, he was going to be that actual Son of God who would be that Son of God forever, because he was the real deal. He was the actual thing that the promise had in mind from the get-go.
And what about the essence part, made of one essence with the Father? So there's the only begotten made of one essence with the Father, by whom all things were made.
Well, that's what I suggested last week, is that I think that what the creeds reflect, what we think of as Christianity, what that reflects is a synthesis between biblical vocabulary, biblical ideas, biblical teaching, and Greek philosophical speculation about essences, hypostases, persons, what being is greater than what other being, and all that kind of stuff. Where is that coming from? You don't find any discussion of that in the scriptures, right? New Testament, you'll look in vain for any kind of discussion about the ontology of angels, even, or Jesus, or God, or anything like that. That's all coming from the Greek culture, where the intellectual culture of the Greeks was very much into that kind of metaphysical speculation. So it's when Greek metaphysical speculation collides with the language and vocabulary of biblical Christianity that you end up getting a synthesis. And I would argue that what we think of as Christianity is a syncretistic religion that was formed out of the collision of Greek metaphysical speculation and biblical vocabulary and concepts. And essences is right at the collision point there. The whole idea of essences comes from giving a Greek answer to a Jewish question.
The Greeks seek for wisdom, but the Jews for a sign.
Uh-huh. Yes. And I think something like that is very much behind Paul's statement there. He's understanding the culture of the Greeks and what it is they're looking for.
So God in the Old Testament has appeared in human form, like the man who appeared to Abraham.
That's right.
Or the angel that
right.
wrestled with. So how is that different than
okay.
what you're talking about,
okay.
Jesus?
Great question. The man who, what she's referring to is, remember, 1 year before Isaac is born, three men show up at Abraham's tent, and he feeds them dinner. And after dinner, two of them are going off to warn Lot to get out of Sodom because he's going to destroy Sodom. One of them remains behind, and Abraham talks to him as if he's God himself. He negotiates with him. This man is speaking with the very authority of Yahweh himself. That's a theophany. And you have a number of theophanies in the Old Testament. That's one. I think the man who wrestled with Jacob was a theophany. The burning bush is a theophany. The pillar of fire and cloud that guided Israel through the wilderness is a theophany. Because the passages will talk about following the cloud and then talk about how it was Yahweh leading them. Well, why? How was he leading them? Well, that was him. That was his manifestation of himself to them. The glory that appeared, what the rabbis later called the Shekinah glory, that appeared over the Holy of Holies, the tent of meeting that Moses would go into, that was a theophany. That's God manifesting himself. Well, God can manifest himself in a lot of different ways. A burning bush, a bright shining light, a pillar of fire, a cloud, a man. However he wants to manifest himself, he can manifest himself in a theophany. But notice the difference. In a theophany speaks in the first person. The burning bush said to Moses, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Right? I, the one that's speaking to you, the one that's appearing to you, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Jesus never says that. Jesus says, hello, I'm Jesus of Nazareth. I'm the Son of the living God. I have a unique relationship to God. I'm not a theophany. I'm not God just pretending to be a human being. I'm not a God just appearing in human form. I'm actually a human being, Jesus of Nazareth. I'm a human being, and I'm the one that he sent into the world as his Son to fulfill all these promises and be with you like forever. Now, he is Yahweh, but he's not merely a theophany. He's a human being who is a real human being who is Yahweh. I would imagine that you will never find traces of the man that appeared to Abraham. He zooms in and he zooms out, and he's no ongoing existence. He had no history and he had no future. It was just God appearing in that way. Jesus has an ongoing, continuing existence as a real human being the minute he's created. So that's the difference.
I've always wondered about Jesus' temptation and his crucifixion, and if he was God, was that cheating?
Right.
And so finally, your explanation of who Jesus is makes sense of it for me.
Yeah.
And the hugely incredible person that he was.
Yeah.
And it makes him even more huge to me than he was before. So thank you.
No, I agree. Yeah, absolutely.
Molly? You called God a person. Can you describe that a little bit more? I know that I tend to think of him as human. He's clearly not. He's much bigger. or I think a lot of people talk in those terms, but you say person, so can you describe that a little bit more?
Yeah, basically by person, I mean a being that has a mind, a will, and the freedom to use them. That's a person. Unlike animals can be the facsimile of personhood. They can, you know, dogs can be cute and stuff like that. But they're just little organic robots. You know, they're just following their programming and doing what their programming says to do. Human beings are different. We are persons in a way that dogs are not persons. you can apply moral categories to us. I'm either good or I'm evil. Dogs are either dangerous or not dangerous. We are good or evil. Moral categories meaningfully apply to us. And why moral categories? Because we're free. I'm not just following my programming. I'm resolving my will to do good or to do evil. And I'm responsible for the choice I make. I'm blameworthy or praiseworthy accordingly. Does that make sense?
But he's not human.
God?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, he's not human at all.
Okay.
But see, we are made in the image of God. And I think the image, being made in the image of God means God is the first and most important person. We are persons as a reflection of our Creator. That, I think that's what it means to be made in the image of God. We are moral beings because we reflect God in a way that nothing else in God's creation reflects him. So we are all made in the image of God, but there's only one human being who is the distinct, unique image of the invisible God, and that's Jesus. I bear personhood, but I don't bear God's unique identity, individual identity. Jesus does that. I don't. Never have, never will.
If this is too much of a bunny trail, ignore it. Would you consider Melchizedek a theophany, since it mentions that he has no mother or father or genealogy?
Yeah, that's a bigger... We can talk about that. That's a bigger question. No, I don't think he was. I think he was just a plain old ordinary Jebusite who knew Abraham. But we can talk about that.
Let's see here. So I guess my question revolves around the issue of, you talked about the Greeks. We think about Jesus having God's stuff. And you're saying Jesus, we're being too materialistic if we think about Jesus having God's stuff. But obviously God, you're arguing Jesus though is to be identified with Yahweh and has his identity. And I guess it's just a little bit difficult in the sense that obviously Jesus, and even the church fathers would say, Jesus, what did materially possess God's stuff, in the sense that, I mean, his body, his material substance wasn't divine. But I think they would say that in his consciousness, in his spirit, so to speak, they would say there was a union between his divine, there was a, you know, a union between the divine nature and the human nature while they still remain distinct. So it seems as though they're saying is that, no, Jesus isn't made of God's stuff, but there is in Jesus' spirit spiritual identity with God, which, I mean, metaphysically, we always use physical things to represent metaphysical realities, and so we say, you know, a nature. Jesus had a divine nature to him. But how is that different from what you're saying? I mean, isn't Jesus identifying with God the same thing as saying he had a divine nature of some sort?
Exactly. How is that any different? I mean, on the one hand, I don't think it's different. I'm making the same claim that Orthodoxy is claiming. He's God and man simultaneously. But the problem is, I really don't know what the Church Fathers meant. They are as far in the distance almost as the Bible itself, and what they mean by their vocabulary is a very challenging exegetical issue. So I'm not a patristic scholar. I haven't studied their writings. I don't have any firm conclusions about what they meant. But I do know what we think they meant. That is, I do know how that's come down to us in modern-day Christianity. And what do we say? Jesus had a divine nature, read stuff, and a human nature, read stuff. The human nature, the stuff of human nature, is the familiar stuff, matter, physics, chemistry, and all that kind of stuff. What is the divine stuff? Well, I don't know, but it's stuff-like without being stuff, right? I mean, it's material without being material. That's what I mean by materialist. Our mental image is of stuff, even if we turn around and deny it. Oh, well, God can't be made of stuff, so it's not really stuff. Well, what is it? Well, it acts like stuff. I mean, isn't that the way we have put our picture of Jesus together? If not, if I'm the only one, then shame on me. But
you're the only one, Jack.
Okay. That's how I put it together growing up in Christian tradition. And then there's that magical thing. So what the Church Fathers said is human stuff and divine stuff can't intermingle and mix together, and yet they have to be one in one person. So how do we explain the divine and the human in the one person? They said the hypostatic union. Because we have a divine hypostasis and we have a human hypostasis, and what sticks them together in one is the hypostatikos union, right? Now, how do you define a hypostatic union? It's that force that makes two things that can't be one, one.
Right. And then what they're trying to do is just basically understand Jesus being divine without creating. I think one of their goals is that they understand God not to be changing. So that's really important to them, is that God doesn't change. And so the translation from God to human is a problematic one because it involves change. Also, the principle that God doesn't change, if you define God by certain characteristics, Jesus has to contain all the characteristics of God, because if he's not omniscient, then he lacks one of the characteristics that defines God and therefore lacks God's identity. So it's very important to I think, an even modern understanding of the incarnation is that Jesus has to possess all those characteristics, otherwise he lacks identity.
Right.
Now that might be, I think in one sense that's kind of what you're denying.
Exactly, that's what I'm denying.
That Jesus doesn't have to have all God's characteristics for God, for him to have God's identity.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm denying.
Right. I guess some people would have trouble with that. I guess
some people. Notice that it's taken me 500 years to get up here and say this.
One more thing, and I'll be done. In John 1, it says that John bore witness of him and cried out, saying, "This is he whom I said, he who comes after me has a higher rank than I, for he existed before me." So earlier you said that there's no place in the Bible where it says, "Hi, I'm Jesus, and you know I existed before I was born of Mary." It's kind of what you're implying. But it seems as though here John is saying that Jesus did exist, and the word in Greek is the word for exist, like being. So it seems to be that Scripture does speak of Jesus as having a prior existence. Now maybe that's not stuff. Maybe that's transcendent, not stuff. But basically,
well,
it seems
let me save that till next week, and I'll comment on that. I have notes on that. I've worked all that out, but I can't recall it right at the moment.
Okay.
So, and it's too important to butcher it. So yeah, I'll comment on that next week.
Thanks.
So you did a fine job of explaining how Jesus is a man just like we are. But I don't understand what the difference is between him and I, because when I get tired, I tend to hurt the people around me, and Jesus didn't.
Well, he's like me, except that the way Paul puts it, he came in the likeness of sinful flesh. Now, you and I and every other human being on the planet, being like us means being a sinner. Jesus is unique in that regard. And notice that you know, part of his destiny was to be the last Adam, that is, the first of an entirely new race of human beings, a whole new way of being a human being. And one of the significant differences between the children of the first Adam and those of us who are brothers of the last Adam, the significant difference is children of the first Adam are all universally sinners. Brothers of the last Adam, none of us will be sinners. So what he was, we will be. You know, what he was and went on to become, we will become what he became. And a big, huge part of that is we're going to be cured of our sinfulness. We will no longer be sinful. So yeah, you're describing who we are right now. But that's an old humanity. That's the original humanity. But the new humanity that he came to be on the vanguard of is sinless humanity.
That's good. I know that he's like the new prototype of human being. But that seems like almost fundamentally different from this old human being that I am.
Well, okay, I'm afraid that what you're thinking is that when he got tired, he didn't feel like you do. I would maintain, no, he felt exactly like you do, but he made different choices.
It seems like you make different choices out of your strength of character.
Sorry?
It seems like you make different choices out of your strength of character. I think if I work hard enough, then I won't make those choices, and I could be like Jesus.
Good
I don't think
that.
That's true.
Good luck with that.
I understand that that's not right, Jack. But it seems, I don't understand what that difference is. That's where hung up.
It's not ontological. It's the choices that he's being scripted by God, the author, to be an entirely radically different kind of human being. The choices he makes, he doesn't make out of his biology, his blood sugar, his genes, it's not determined that he act the way he does. He's free. He's acting out of his freedom. If he weren't acting out of his freedom, why would it be praiseworthy? It's because he's acting out of his freedom that it's human, it's moral, and so when he chooses good rather than evil out of his freedom, that's a different kind of dude than you and me. Because we get pressed to the limit and feel all the temptation to be selfish, hateful, cruel, and everything that we do, and we say yes to that. We freely choose to be those people. Jesus, I think, felt all the same temptations that we do, but he chose differently.
What is it about Jesus that allowed him to freely choose the other instead of the way that I freely choose?
Well, nothing in this realm, nothing caused him to do good rather than evil. He chose to be good rather than evil. See, we've become so accustomed to blaming our sin on our sin nature. Well, that's not true. Sin nature is sort of a philosophical fiction. It doesn't exist. But it simply describes the pattern of the free choices that I have made throughout my life. Look at the trajectory of my choices. It's toward evil and away from God, away from good. But it can't possibly be that it's something in me that causes me to do evil. If it were, how am I accountable? If my sin nature makes me do it, then I'm not blameworthy for my sin. But the Bible clearly makes me blameworthy for my sin. Why? Because it thinks that I'm making those choices out of my freedom. And so if my sin nature doesn't make me do evil, God's or Jesus' sinless nature doesn't make him do good either. It's no nature makes us act the way we act. It's we're not animals. Sure. I'm not operating out of my inner programming and doing what my inner programming makes me do. These are not instincts. If they were instincts, I wouldn't be blameworthy. They are what I decide to do in that secret, quiet, lonely moment of me resolving my will. I will obey or I will disobey. I will do good or I will do evil. I will do love or I will do not love.
I see. So you're just telling me that there is nothing different, nothing, absolutely nothing different between the new prototype and the old prototype.
Except the choices we make in our freedom. Exactly.
Okay.
See, when I get into eternity, I'm going to be free to do evil, but I just ain't going to do it. No longer in the script for me to do evil in eternity.
Thanks.
I hate to say this, but that's a whole can of worms for me. Okay. And do I understand you to say that, and it's how I've always understood it, Jesus did not have a sin nature. I have a sin nature.
Are you saying, is that what I'm saying?
Yes.
It depends what you mean by that, is what I'm saying. If you want to say, I have a sin nature, in that becomes a very helpful philosophical fiction for describing my life, then yes, I have a sin nature, and Jesus doesn't. If we want to say by that, I have a power pack in me that forces me to do evil and sin, and Jesus didn't have that. He had a power pack in him that causes him to do righteousness and goodness. Then I'm saying, no, that's not true.
Okay, here's my example. So the other morning when I was walking to Bible study, I'm walking along the street, and this woman steps out in front of me, right, and is standing there pretty much taking up the whole sidewalk, right? I have this thought that flashes through my head. It's not a very good thought, and I'm not going to share it, Jack. But afterwards, at that moment, I have a decision to make, right? And I remember having a secondary thought saying, man, where did that come from? It's like flashes across. It just bubbles out of me. And then when I have time to consider it, I realize that this is not okay, mm-hmm. right? Well, are you saying, it's my understanding, Jesus didn't have those types of thoughts that bubble up out of some place inside him, that he then gets to decide how he's going to react to that?
Right, because I think some of our desires are, and some of our impulses are literally perverse desires and perverse impulses. Did Jesus have those? No. Why do we have those? I mean, to a certain extent, they're a function of my choices, my training, the habits I've formed. I mean, there's all kinds of things that probably go into that. And those same things that go into making those perverse desires and impulses in us didn't create those in Jesus, I would assume. So, yeah, I think there's a significant difference between us and Jesus in the way that you describe. But I think to the extent... To the extent that how I act is how I'm acting in my freedom, in theory, there's not a single one of us who couldn't have, in principle, taken the path that Jesus did and become sinless like he was. But we didn't. We didn't. And it was not in the script. There's no way where we were going to. So understand what I'm saying that. By theoretically, I mean just in terms of the nature of my ontology. It's not my humanity that made me sin. It's me that made me sin. Because okay. Jesus had the same humanity but didn't sin.
I've heard you talk at another time about motives, that often we don't even really understand our motives. It's not till later, maybe way past a situation we're looking back with some clarity, to realize that the motives we thought were good and the actions that we thought were good at the time actually were fairly tainted. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, that and I've heard you speak about that. That goes to the level of our depravity. We have, you know, it's hard for us to even to comprehend right. how depraved we really are.
Right.
And then Jesus didn't suffer from any of that, though.
Right, exactly. You're right. Yeah. And sin nature can become a very, very convenient philosophical concept to describe all that. It's just very important that we understand what we're doing when we say sin nature. We're using that as a concept to describe all that. But does my sin nature make me make the choices that I do? No.
Okay.
It describes the choices that I do make and have made.
One final question, right? I was born as a son of Adam under the curse, right? Jesus, if how you're describing the virgin birth, right, was also in one sense born from Adam, but he was not under the curse.
Well, in a way, I think he was. That's what Paul means when he says he came in the likeness of sinful flesh. I think he came in the likeness of cursed flesh. I think he had a body that would die, just like mine. Yeah, it was the same body that I have. Now, his destiny was to be translated into another old order of existence, and that's we're going to follow him. Where he was the... He later in Romans, he says that we might... thank you. That he would be the firstborn among many brethren, and that we would be conformed to the likeness of God's Son. So we're going to follow him there, but he started off exactly where we start off, a body that would break down, a human being born into this world of death, subject to corruption, because this creation that he entered was subjected to futility, as he says in Romans 8, by God himself, in order that we might one day be set free into the freedom of the glory of the children of God. Okay, I'm sure there's a lot of questions left. I do want to do one in the 15 minutes that remain. I want to shift gears a little bit, just because I have it here now, and I don't know if it'll be here next week. some final comments on the Trinity. What about all those passages that a Trinitarian would look at in the Bible and find evidence for the doctrine of the Trinity in them? What are we supposed to do with that? I kind of mentioned last week, there's probably hundreds of passages that a Trinitarian might point to and say, well, see, this indicates the Trinity, this indicates the Trinity, this indicates the Trinity. Well, the thing we have to understand, we have to think deeply and have a certain sophisticated understanding of the nature of language and the nature of language interpretation. If we don't, then this is hopeless. A text in language will always have a number of plausible readings. It's not like if I just flash up a sentence here, we automatically and inevitably have to know what that sentence means. I need to know context. I need to know background. There's all kinds of other information surrounding that that's going to push me to take it one way rather than another way. But any reading that I give it, unless I'm a total blooming idiot, any reading that I give it is going to be plausible, it's going to be intelligent, it's going to be rational. I mean, why would I give it an irrational interpretation? So of course I'm going to give it a plausible interpretation. And there are probably several of them available in any assertion that anybody makes in any language anywhere. Well, when it comes to the Bible, if you just give me a sentence out of the Bible, I'm going to bring with me a certain set of a priori theological assumptions. You know what I mean by a priori? A priori is what I already have, I already believe, I already contain as my theological framework. I already believe that's true. And when you believe something is true, you're always going to assume that any statement that you also assume to be true is going to reflect and conform to your a priori assumptions, your set of assumptions that you already have a priori. So your a priori assumptions are going to dictate what seems to be the most natural reading of any text, of any sentence or any verse in the Bible. The most natural way to take it is going to be different for two different people. Because if one person has one theology, the text will have the most natural reading for him. Somebody else comes up with a different theology, that same verse is going to have a different, more natural reading to him. So when we talk about what's the more natural interpretation, notice that that's not worth much. Because what makes an interpretation most natural is simply a reflection of what your a priori assumptions were that you brought to the text. Let me illustrate what I'm talking about. This is a famous Wittgenstein made this famous. It didn't actually use this image, but he just used a simple little line drawing to illustrate this point. Is that a duck or a rabbit? Okay, let's riot over this, shall we? When you first encounter this picture, if you're told it's a picture of a duck, or if you're told to look for the duck, you'll see a duck. And seeing a duck is the most natural way to understand the picture, because you've already been told that's what you should be looking for. On the other hand, if you were told ahead of time this is a picture of a rabbit, or look for the rabbit, then seeing the rabbit is going to be the most natural way to see the picture. Because it can be both, not very good either, but it can be both. This is an even better example. A very famous illustration. Is that a young woman or an old woman? How many people see the young woman? How many people see the old woman? Anyone not see them both now? This is a better example because it's hard, if you don't. You really kind of have to work at it to see the old woman, I think. The younger woman is easier to see for me. You have to really work at it to see the old woman. But once you see the old woman, you realize, yeah, it's really there. That's what this is a picture of. Now, if I were to tell you this is a picture of an old woman, and you said, well, no, it's not. It's a picture of a young woman, and that's the most natural way to take the picture. Well, really? What if the artist intended this to be the picture of the old woman? Then that's the right way to read the picture, no matter that the other one seems more natural to you. Why would it seem more natural to you? Well, in, it would especially seem more natural to you if you've been set up by someone suggesting to you to start with, I'm going to show you a picture of a young woman. Then that's a slam dunk. Sure. Okay, there's a picture of a young woman. What my contention is, biblical interpretation is exactly like that. That when you come into a text, none of us are in theological neutral. All of us have a certain set of assumptions, theological assumptions, a whole paradigm, theological paradigm, that we bring to the text, and we expect to see it reflected back at us from the text. So we come looking for a young woman, we expect to see the young woman reflected back at us, and we look and we see it. So when someone like me comes along and says, you know, I think it's actually an old woman, you'll fight me about it. You'll resist it. And it's only natural that you would resist it because you have been set up to expect the young woman. You see the young woman. You see it clearly. There's no question in your mind but what you see the young woman clearly. And so when I tell you it's an old woman, you'll fight me. But what if I were the author of the drawing and I intended it to be a drawing of an old woman? Then you would be wrong. What you're seeing ain't there. Well, that's how the debate is going to go about certain passages that teach the Trinity. We have all, from the minute we were born, been set up to see the Trinity in verse after verse after verse after verse after verse. Can you see it when you've been set up to see it? Absolutely. Of course you can see it. Because you're intelligent. And since you're intelligent, and there are many plausible readings that you can give to a text, you're going to give the reading to the text that conforms to what you expect to see. And you expect to see the truth in the Bible, and the truth has been certifiably guaranteed to you to be the Trinity, the Trinitarian doctrine. So you expect to see it, and you find it. Of course you find it. And it becomes the most natural way to read a whole variety of passages. But is it what the authors intended? That's a different question. If they intended an old woman and you're seeing a young woman, then you're getting it wrong no matter how compelling and natural what you perceive feels to you, no matter how natural it feels to you. So the key to all this is it's important that we don't use the criteria of what seems most natural when I read a text. Rather, we have to go to the work of looking at how my interpretation interprets the paragraph and the series of paragraphs, the argument that surrounds it, which reading unlocks the meaning of the argument. It's the meaning that unlocks the meaning of the argument that is what the author intended. However counterintuitive that might feel, because it doesn't show me what I expected to find there in it. Okay, that's a little abstract. We have 7 minutes, so I can take a couple questions.
Actually, it wasn't a question so much as, could you do the same example using like John 8:58? That John 8:58 is where Jesus says, he's, you know, I am. Before Abraham was, I am.
Okay.
And it seems to be he's saying, okay. I am that I am, which is okay. God. So.
Well, okay, there's several different issues there. We can talk about this in the future, perhaps, but the whole idea that I am means God is an artificial interpretation that we've inherited. First of all, I'm not at all sure that the name Yahweh is actually best translated I am. Notice that the Septuagint, when it translates it it translates it he who is rather than I am. I like that better because I think that captures his name and his title better. But that aside,
I know the Jews understood him to say that he was saying that, you know, I am, because when he said that, then they were going to kill him.
That's what we've been told to expect there. That's the duck. Or the the young woman. But I think if we pause, do the work, take the time to look at the whole argument in context, and we won't have time to do it thoroughly here. What I would contend is that's not what it means. That's not why they're going to kill him. They want to kill him because he's claiming to be more important than their father Abraham, and he flat out is saying that. Because they say, who do you think you are? You're greater than our father Abraham. You're not yet 50 years old. You're around when Abraham was around. You think you're a bigger deal than he was. And to summarize his answer, yes, I do. I think I'm a bigger deal than Abraham was, because before Abraham was, I am there at the center of God's purposes, of God's plans, of God's script. Abraham was created for me. Because before God even created the cosmos, I was there as the person who was centermost in the storyline of this history that God was going to create. Now, does that mean he actually had actual existence and being? No, I don't think so. Any more than John the Baptist existed before John the Baptist was born, even though John the Baptist was the voice crying in the wilderness in Isaiah, right? But doesn't mean that John the Baptist existed, but he was foreseen by God as a part of and instrumental to his purposes and his storyline. Well, I think that's what Jesus is saying. The one for whom everything that was made, the most important being in all of God's creation, existed as that most important being before there was even a creation at all.
There once was a woman on a tour of the National Gallery, just a little Midwestern housewife, and when they got to this painting by Matisse, she pointed out that they had hung it upside down, and the tour guy said, "Lady, don't mess with me here, we're doing a tour." She said, "But you're hanging it up, it's hung upside down." And she got in this big fight, and they called the curator, and they had an examination, and they turned it right side up, because she was right. She was a longtime fan in magazines of his art. And the curator had hung it upside down. What we have, besides this dynamic, is the belief that we don't have a right to tell the curator
right.
that you hung that upside down.
Right. Right.
Because after all, who are we?
Right.
And I think when you say, well, of course you see the Trinity, you've been told to see the Trinity. We've been told that by people who love us and care for us and raised us.
Right.
And so on one hand, you should believe it because they loved you and cared for you and raised you. They introduced you to the living God and the Christ who saved you. I mean, they're right about this thing, but I think that is as much a dynamic as anything else.
Right.
That's
right.
That. But those are the church fathers. But this is, you know, Newton. This is... pick anyone who wrote a great hymn or a good book, C.S. Lewis. I mean, who are you to go up against C.S. Lewis? Well, maybe he just hung that one upside down.
Right. That's well said. Because there are a lot of very, very godly and great minds who have not bothered to even think about this. And they have been told to look at it this way, and they look at it this way, and they do a lot of great work. So this is not to denigrate the wonderful things that they have contributed to our lives at all. And I like the way you said it. But if they got this one hung upside down, they got this one hung upside down. It doesn't have to be that big a deal. I mean, we are all, every one of us who have written books and written commentaries and written systematic theologies and anything that we've done, all of us are human beings, and all of us have made some mistakes, and all of us have been sort of misguided in our thinking about some aspects of it. Why would that come as a surprise to us if that were the case? Gotta let you go. We'll just take it up here next week.